InDesign just has a superior typesetting engine. That's the main thing. The way that it flows text, the text looks just very professional. Sometimes with a book that has been published from Word, you can tell because you'll see rivers of white space, for example, running through a page. Something is off or wonky about the spacing of the words, or you'll see very bizarre hyphenation, or sometimes something should be hyphenated and isn't, or vice versa. But InDesign takes care of all that in the background. That's just part of what it does.
That's Anne-Marie Concepcion of Seneca Design, talking about InDesign. Now, for all of you who believe that there is a lot more to life than what you can do in Microsoft Word, keep listening. Anne-Marie has a ton more to say, and a surprising nickname. We'll be hearing that and the full interview in just a few minutes. Thanks again for streaming in. Welcome to Inside Independent Publishing from IBPA, the Independent Book Publishers Association. I'm an independent publisher, and I'm your host, Peter Goodman. IBPA's mission is to lead and serve the independent publishing community through advocacy, education, and tools for success. And that's partially what this podcast is all about. For more about IBPA and how it can help you be a better publisher and sell more books, whatever kind of publisher you are, go to ibpa-online.org. Okay, it's time to take up some of your questions. Once again, Caitlin Walker from the IBPA office in Southern California is here to provide advice and guidance. Hey, Caitlin.
Hi, Peter.
Any good questions from the membership?
Yeah, we do have some questions here. First question is from W. Bartell of Salt and Light Book, and it's regarding royalty payments to foreign publishers. So they ask, I have a contract with a foreign publisher to whom I am to pay net royalties once a year. What costs are taken out of the gross before calculating net? Do I list specific direct costs in the royalty statement? Do I understand correctly that direct costs are graphics and printing? Are design and editing part of direct costs? If so, is there an industry standard to charge? The contract specifies the percent of net to be paid in royalties, and the foreign publisher pays the author a percentage of that. So we do have a couple answers here. Our first one is from R. Fisher of Generation 30 Publishing House. They respond with, if you are looking to understand net and gross, this is something that should have descriptors in adjusted costs and rates versus fixed and variable and chargeable services or fees passed on to the author. For example, transaction fees. We've learned not to give away the cart and the horse. There should have been, somewhere in your contract, quote, fees and, quote, services and, quote, pass on costs. So I'm actually going to hand this one over to Peter because he has an answer for this question as well.
At my company, we do have some arrangements with foreign publishers, and we end up having to pay royalties. So I'm a bit familiar with this. And one thing I will say is that all these items really should be covered by your contract. And if they're not, then you need to renegotiate your contract. Generally, you pay net on your total sales without deducting any of your costs like shipping, editorial, manufacturing. In many cases, bank fees are called out in contracts as payable by each side separately, or sometimes the contract will specify that the bank fees are the responsibility of the licensee. That is you, if you're the one who's making the deal to publish the work from a publisher overseas, you're the licensee. Taxes should always be the sole responsibility of the licensor, that is the company that sold you the rights. But there are ways of reducing tax burdens by filing paperwork, and that might require the cooperation of both parties. The main thing you have to take away from this is that everything must be spelled out in the contract, or it is open to the self-serving interpretation of either side. And since you're asking about standard rates and amounts, there really is no such thing. So you really just have to nail everything down. Make sure you understand the numbers behind the transaction.
We do have another, it's actually not a question, but it is some really helpful printing advice from a newsletter that Angela, our CEO, actually shared in one of the IBPA forums. So this newsletter comes in to Angela from Mr. Steve Waxman, and I have a couple excerpts from this. I do have a link where members can find the article online on the forums, which I'll read to you after, but start with the article itself. Waxman explains, I recently found a breakdown of levels of printing quality in a book called Getting It Printed by Mark Beach and Eric Kenley. It is actually one of the first books on printing I ever read many decades ago, and I still think it's one of the best. Getting It Printed distinguishes among basic, good, premium, and showcase level work. In a chart called Guide to Printing Quality, the book then addresses the quantifiable tolerances that constitute the various levels of quality. In manufacturing in general, and printing specifically, quality comes at a price, whether it be in terms of money or time. Another approach to quality, which really means meeting or exceeding certain standards, is to match the level of quality to the importance of the job, and of course, to have measurable criteria by which you can judge the level of quality. More than anything, this is a guide to help you select a printer. First, you need to determine how the printed product will be used and for what length of time. You can select an appropriate printer for the job with this information. So I'm just actually going to give an example that I noticed in this newsletter because I did read through it. He uses the example of getting, you know, a flyer printed versus getting a photograph book printed. Using a level of printing like Showcase or Premium for something very basic is going to cost you too much. It's going to take a lot of time, and it's really not the ideal type of printing for that type of paper or document. So I would recommend taking a look at this article, but also really look into what you are trying to distribute and what you're creating. And that can really save you a lot of time and money, as well as help connect you with the right printer for your needs. And for anyone who is interested in reading the full article, members can access it on our forums. Look at the notes when the podcast is ended, and we'll be able to get a link to the forums where you can sign in and read the entire newsletter.
And is it also available on the IBPA website itself?
No, it is only available on the forum, which is accessible to members only. So you would need to be a member to be able to read the complete text.
All right. And if you're not a member, just check the notes of the podcast and follow the link from there. Well, thanks a lot, Caitlin. Until next time, take care.
Thank you. You as well, Peter.
Now, if you have a question for me or anyone at IBPA, just contact us on the IBPA website, ibpa-online.org, or message us on Twitter using the handle at IBPA. Be sure to put the word podcast in the message so your question gets to the right place. So today's guest is Anne-Marie Concepcion. Welcome, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. Let me tell you a little bit about Anne-Marie. She is the founder and president of Seneca Design and Training, which provides cross-media consulting, training, design, and publishing services. She is widely known as one of a very few digital publishing gurus, having worked and taught in this field for 25 years, since the early days of PageMaker and Quark Express, meaning I assume you remember mechanicals and stuff like that.
I got into the field just as they were on their way out. I did buy a waxer, and I never had to cut Ruby Lith, but I hired somebody who did.
I see. Well, that's a lost skill, and you don't know what you missed. She is also the co-host of the InDesignSecrets.com blog and podcast with David Blattner, with whom she also co-authored Adobe InDesign CS2 Breakthroughs. And most important, she is known as her geekness.
That's right. My clients called me that in a fun, affectionately teasing manner about 15 years ago. They told somebody that in their company, they call me her geekness because they could ask me just about any question having to do with design and computers, and I would usually know the answer. And that was their private name for me, and I just thought it was so cool that I adopted it. And in fact, I bought the domain name and all that kind of fun stuff.
Oh, you bought the domain name even?
Yeah. Hergeekness.com. Hmm?
I see. Well, now that geeks have inherited the earth, you're right at the top of the heap then.
That's right, buddy.
Yeah. I don't know who is his geekness.
I haven't met him yet, but I know he's out there somewhere.
All right. Well, if you'd like to know more about Anne-Marie Concepcion and what she does, check out SenecaDesign.com. Well, let's answer that question. What is it exactly that you do at Seneca Design?
Seneca Design was a company I started, like you said, about 25 years ago. What happened, Peter, is that I wanted to be a teacher, and I was actually tried to teach high school. I was a speech and theater teacher, and the school just kind of closed because there were not enough students. So I was sort of bouncing around in various jobs and ended up teaching at a college, general education, and somebody brought in, there was awful of PCs, but somebody brought in a Mac. My boss, the dean of students, brought in a Macintosh. And when I saw what that Mac could do, I clearly remember him showing me the Mac Plus and what Mac Paint could do compared to, you know, I was trying to teach myself basic on these IBM PCs pre-Windows. And I couldn't believe it. And I tried to figure out a way to make a living playing on that computer, to have a reason to buy the computer, which I think was like $10,000-$15,000 at the time. And the, well, maybe not that much, but it was a few thousand, and a printer was $7,000. I remember that. A laser writer was $7,000. Yes, yes. And that's what happened, is that I quit and I went to work as a waitress at night and learned how to do graphic design on the computer by day. And ever since then, that's what Seneca Design and Training has been. I called it Seneca because I was reading an article from Ms. Magazine at the time that talked about Seneca Falls, New York was going to have the 100th anniversary of the first women's convention. So it was kind of like a woman empowerment kind of thing, starting my own business. So I thought it would have a special meaning to me. I regret it now because Seneca comes at the end of the alphabet. I didn't realize how alphabet's lists of things actually discriminate against people who are less than D.
This is why aardvark design is so successful.
Yeah, I should have called Anne-Marie design. I don't know. That was stupid. But so half of the business is doing design work on the computer, and the other half is teaching people because I couldn't get away from teaching. And I'm an Adobe certified instructor for basically these days InDesign and InCopy is what I specialize in. InCopy is the editorial adjunct to InDesign. For design work, we're doing a lot of ebook conversions. Authors or small publishers will hire me to take their manuscript and turn it into an ebook for the iPad and the Kindle. Yeah, so that's what I do.
As we were talking before we actually got to broadcast, a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast, I believe, are what you might call author publishers. They are people who are basically trying to manage all the work themselves. Part of it is because I think they want to have complete control over what they do. And a lot of it is cost savings, figuring if they can do it themselves, they might be able to save some money. And of course, there are, as we know, false economies, certain things you shouldn't try and do on your own. People try and take, I think, their skills as far as they can. I would say that 99 to 100% of all the people who are producing books of that nature either work in or have to deal with Microsoft Word. That's like the starting place, I think, for most people. What do you think of publishers using Microsoft Word as kind of a book design, book layout platform? Is it possible?
I would say no. I would say you would give the Word file to somebody who knows what they're doing and then lay it out for publication. You can't even convert a Word file to a proper ebook. There is no save as or export to EPUB, which is the open standard for ebooks. And then as far as publishing is concerned, you know, Word does all sorts of scary things. It will fake bolds and italics. If you don't have that font installed, it'll make it look like you have that font installed, which comes out looking horrible. It changes the line endings depending on which printer you have selected as the default printer. It does all sorts of crazy things. There are many services that will take your Word file and convert it to something that can be published. I think Amazon will take your Word file if you want to turn it into a Kindle ebook, or a service like Smashwords, which converts your Word files if you follow their instructions carefully about how to set it up. They'll convert it to something for an ebook. And then I think if you use CreateSpace, which or similar kind of services that will take your manuscript and turn it into a print-on-demand published printed book, I think they take Word files too. I'm not sure. But, you know, you're giving your Word file to their in-house designers who then will flow it into InDesign probably, or into some sort of automated program that fixes the faux fonts and other issues with Word files. So, no, Word file is a great program. I do love it and I use it constantly, but it's not for publishing.
I mean, I've definitely seen some books that like Lightning Sources produced on their from their print on demand, where people created a file in Word and then obviously just exported it as a PDF. And then that PDF, I guess, you know, everything is locked in and then it goes up.
You, when you and I were talking, I was trying to think, you said, like, which program should people use for publishing? And I said, what program would people be using for publishing other than InDesign? Because as far as I know, from many years in the publishing field, the vast majority of anything published that's longer than a couple pages long is InDesign. Or to a lesser, far lesser extent these days, Quark Express. Maybe Publisher, maybe Apple Pages, but definitely not Word. So when I work with authors or small publishers, they'll often give me their manuscript in Word format and we flow it into InDesign and then set it there and then send them PDFs or a draft EPUB to say, how does this look to you?
Well, this is a good jumping in point because I'm like you. I work in InDesign and almost all the authors developers that I work with, they give me their stuff in Microsoft Word, and invariably it needs to be cleaned up. The way that I work, I don't charge them for that cleanup work, but other people might. So what are some things that you see in Word files that come to you that would be easy for an author, say, to just not do and save you and them a lot of time and money?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, though, I have to back up a little bit and say the first thing an author should do with their Word file is send it to an editor. When I get an author's raw manuscript, I ask them if they would like to pay us for editing or would they like a referral to an independent editor.
Amory, just to are you talking about developmental editing, copy editing, or?
Yes, yes and yes. Yes, yes and yes. Yes. Even before we get to that stage of laying it out, I just want to put in a plug here for all of my editorial brethren that there is no author, no Pulitzer Prize winning author that could not get a much better book out of having it copy edited or proofread at least by an editor. So I would recommend that. I've worked with many independent authors that give us something that is their life's work and honestly is just so difficult to get through, to whack through the weeds, that we almost insist on them having it work through an editor and then we get something back that's cleaner. So I would strongly push for that. But assuming that you've done that or you are your own editor and you're confident in your work, the kind of things that you want to not do in Word that would make it difficult for somebody in InDesign to clean up are, for example, trying to use tabs to align things or even using a tab to make a first line indent. What I find in Word is that a lot of people bring their typewriter skills to Word and publishing does not use typewriters. It uses typesetting. In InDesign, we often have to spend sometimes hours cleaning up things like first line indents that were set with a tab and replace them with an actual first line indent, double returns or triple returns with authors trying to helpfully put space above a subhead. We have to clean those out because we use a paragraph style that includes space above. I have seen really low res images being placed that we need to go back to them and say we need a high res image and then we'll place it on our own. More recent versions of Word do a much better job if the user will follow things like styles that come with Word. That makes it easier for us because anybody who's doing publishing in InDesign or a professional layout program, they're using paragraph and character styles to make things accurately formatted. And if the Word document comes in with one single style called normal plus applied throughout,
right.
Then that makes it difficult.
Right.
I've saved a couple really, really bad Word files that I've received over the years or their clients have sent me asking, what's wrong with this file? We can't lay it out in InDesign. And I save them in a folder called Nightmares on my hard drive to bring out and show to people at presentations like a doctor will keep, you know, a double appendix in a jar of formaldehyde on their shelves and all those other weirdos things. And one of them was you place a Word file. This is a journal, a historical paper somebody wrote up and you float it into InDesign. You applied the body style. When you applied the body style to about the 3,000 words in the body text, half of them were bold and half of them were not bold. And we're looking at it like we didn't apply bold to any of this text. It didn't look bold in the Word file. What mysterious thing is happening here? And it turns out that the Word author was trying to use styles. They made a headline. They selected it. Instead of clicking the big B for bold, they looked in the styles. But instead of choosing a headline style, they chose a character style called emphasis. And in Word, in the styles panel, on the right-hand side, there's a little paragraph symbol or a little lowercase a. And the lowercase a means this is a character style. You're just supposed to apply them gently to a word or two or a phrase. A paragraph style, you apply to the whole thing. Well, they selected all the words in the headline and applied the character style emphasis, which is a character style for web publishing. Emphasis is for web publishing and it means bold. And then they hit return. They made it left aligned. They started typing. It was still emphasis, right? Because that's what Word and every program, that's what they do. But instead of choosing a different style, they selected the first few words they had typed and turned off bold in the toolbar. So they're still typing with emphasis, except bold has been turned off, which is really the only thing that emphasis does is turn bold on. And then what they had done was that they copied and pasted chunks of text elsewhere in the document, and sometimes it was bold, sometimes it wasn't. Basically, that's what happened, is that when we brought it into InDesign and we applied a single paragraph style to all the text that had the character style emphasis was showing was coming up as bold.
Right, right. Right, because it was staying there, right?
So that's the first lesson. If you're trying to clean up a Word file and you place it into InDesign and you get bizarre formatting, is to select all the text, open up the Character Styles panel in InDesign, and choose None, which is the default and should be applied mostly. And then that fixed it. In fact, I have an entire title on lynda.com, which I publish about 25 video courses, also known as LinkedIn Learning. And one of them is using InDesign and Word together, where I bring out some of those formaldehyde jar nightmares in the video and show this is what the client was confronted with. Here's how to fix it. Here's how to avoid it in your projects.
And that's available on lynda.com.
Can give you a free week's trial that you can post in your show notes for people to use. Otherwise, it's like $30 a month. Well worth it. But, you know, you can try.
One of the things to point out about what you were saying was that one of the advantages of working with Word is that InDesign interprets Word's paragraph and character styles. So that if you do it correctly and cleanly in Word, when you bring it in InDesign, you kind of half the battle is over. Your text is already styled, and then you...
Yes, to a great extent. Because they use different definitions for what is a style and they're different text engines, you're always going to come up with some glitches. One of the features is that if you have a style in Word called body text, and I place it into InDesign, and I turn on the option to keep the Word formatting, in InDesign, if I have a style called body text, the definition of my InDesign style should trump Word's. And it does that about 70% of the time. Why not 100%? It's a question for the ages.
Nothing will let you completely avoid going and polishing stuff in InDesign, but you want to do that anyway. You do all the base level work in Word, make it really clean, get rid of all the junk, and then when you read it into InDesign, you have a much easier time of it.
And InDesign just has a superior typesetting engine. That's the main thing, is that the way that it flows text, the text looks just very professional. Sometimes with a book that has been published from Word, you can tell because you'll see rivers of white space, for example, running through a page. Something is off or wonky about the spacing of the words, or you'll see very bizarre hyphenation, or sometimes something should be hyphenated and isn't, or vice versa. But InDesign takes care of all that in the background. That's just part of what it does. And then there are many other features that you can turn on in InDesign to make like true fractions or beautiful drop caps, things like that that Word just can't do.
So you've made a strong case for people using InDesign to produce books to a professional level. How difficult is it for someone who doesn't really have a background in design and layout and et cetera to learn InDesign? Is it something that they should consider buying if they just have the one book that they're doing?
I would not bother personally. If I just had one book, I would find somebody like me. There are many of us on the internet or a friend of yours who has InDesign, and have them do it. We just published in InDesign magazine. There's another company that I don't think I mentioned earlier that I run with a business partner, David Blattner. We've had this business for about 11 years now called Creative Pro Network. But from that, we publish InDesign Secrets and InDesign Magazine and conferences and such. And so InDesign Magazine is a monthly PDF magazine now in its 11th year of production. And of course, we use InDesign to create it. But the January issue is our top selling single issue. It's because you can buy each issue individually as opposed to subscribing. And that's because of the cover story, which is on book publishing. It's actually called Book Design. And it's written by Nigel French, who's really friendly, funny, approachable, brilliant designer from the UK, who's published Typography in InDesign, kind of like the seminal book. Now, I think it's in its fourth edition, about using all of InDesign's typographical controls. And he wrote this article that is definitely approachable for a beginner, that explains why you'd want to use a master page, why you'd want to create styles, what you should set up in the styles as far as hyphenation and justification are concerned, how to make lines align across a spread. You know, that's called using a grid. How to put folios and that number automatically at the bottom of the pages. How to create a chapter opener that automatically starts at a certain distance from the top of the page as opposed to the other chapters.
That was amazing. I'd been thinking about that for years, and there was a solution.
Yes, yes. And he is brilliant. He's done a bunch of courses on Lynda too, on book design. But when I saw that story, I helped edit it as well as the co-publisher of the magazine. I was like, this could be an EPUB on its own. Just this one feature story. It's incredible. So I would recommend that users take a look at that. If you're going to be doing this, though, for a business, say you're going to be publishing 3 or 4 books a year, even just that, then I would definitely get InDesign, and you can learn it online. There's so many YouTube videos. Of course, there's Lynda videos, or, you know, go to courses. I do webinars on InDesign, that kind of thing. I did a course on Lynda.com called eBook Fundamentals that is not so much a how-to, well, a little bit of a how-to, but it's kind of like, I want to do an eBook. What are my choices? Because it's not just EPUBs, like the things that you might download from Apple's iBookstore. I said earlier is the default standard, but Kindles have 80% of the market for eBooks, and a Kindle book is not an EPUB. You have to sort of convert it to Kindle, and I have a chapter on that. Also, there's iBooks Author from Apple, which is a free program if you have a Mac for creating beautiful interactive eBooks with quizzes and things like, you know, you can zoom in on a picture and have little call-outs appear. Or you can just do a plain old reflowable EPUB, even PDFs as eBooks, because it's so easy to create. Like you said, you could export from Microsoft Word to PDF if you wanted to and call that an eBook. I mean, there's no law against it. Sometimes the problem is that you can't sell a PDF on the Apple iBookstore or on the Kindle store. You can distribute a PDF there for free, but you can't sell it. People sell PDF eBooks from their own website. That's how that's done.
From InDesign, they've improved their export to EPUB. Is that a complete solution? Is it possible to create your book in InDesign and export it to EPUB and have it work flawlessly when you upload it to the various places that you need to?
What a loaded question, Peter. Is it flawless? Nothing in life is flawless, but I would say 98% of the reflowable EPUBs that you export from InDesign will pass EPUB check, which is a validation utility that you need to use to make sure that your EPUB is correctly put together and has all the requisite internal features. Before you can upload a book for sale to most ebook resellers, they say, we only accept valid EPUBs. And that what they mean is you need to run it through this validation checker. And I know that in the InDesign team worked extremely hard to make sure that when you choose export to EPUB, that that EPUB will pass validation. So yes, that will work. But the problem is that validation is just the minimum. You might do something that has a beautiful drop cap in an ebook that works perfectly in iBooks, but chokes on the Kindle. Instead, you get a small letter with a huge line space, or it looks stupid, you know, or on the Nook. I was doing a book for an author who wrote an image-intensive tome on Excel tips. Many, many, many screenshots, and we just could not get it looking exactly the same across the Nook and the iPad for iBooks and the Kindle. So we had to do different versions. Even though we exported from InDesign, we had to open up each one in an ebook editor, which is like a website editor, and edit some of the CSS, some that's the kind of the equivalent of style sheets and other things to make it look presentable. Many, 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 many hours were spent doing that with this poor guy, and he was patient, but we had a charge. We can't do this for free.
And that's very technical. You just, no one's put on earth knowing how to do this stuff, right?
I know. If your book is more of a trade book, if it's mostly text with a few images, like a picture of the author, or, you know, a couple pictures that are, you know, interspersed within the text with a little caption, that's fine. But if you're doing things with screenshots and figured references, side-by-side things, then that's much more difficult. Can be done, but it'll take a lot more work.
The theory then is the author has their manuscript, give it to someone like you or some other designer with facility in design, and ask them to create the print as well as the ebook, and make sure, kind of guarantee as part of the job, that it passes validation on the main platforms. And I think most of our listeners are probably concerned about Kindle. So could you talk a little bit about anything special that might have to be done for authors who want to get their ebooks up into the Amazon?
I think in some ways it's even simpler than iBooks, because you could create an account on the Kindle publisher platform, KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, I think is what they call it. And you could use your existing Amazon account and then upload a Word file, an HTML file. You can't upload an InDesign file, but you can export from InDesign to EPUB and upload that. And then they'll convert it to their format, which is called KF8, Kindle Format 8. That's their current version. I think they may have another one in the works. But KF8 is essentially like EPUB in that it can understand a lot of the underlying cascading style sheet tags. Like if you want subhead to be small caps, for example, you have to declare that in markup that this is small caps and that it'll honor that. If you're creating it from an InDesign file yourself, there is a program that you can download from KDP that lets you convert it to Kindle on your computer first, and then you can preview it. It's called Kindle Previewer, believe it or not. And Kindle Previewer is a free app for Mac or Windows that will let you open an EPUB file and it will convert it to KF8 and then let you view it in the Kindle Previewer app in any one of a number of Kindle models. Because what works in a Kindle HD, like a Fire, might be quite different than what the book looks like on a Paperwhite or one of the earlier Kindle models that were e-ink models. So you can switch among different models to see how it reflows. You can also switch among what does it look like on Android reader versus a large Kindle reader. If you don't like what it looks like, then you go back to InDesign, you fiddle with some settings, maybe you turn off drop caps. I keep going back to drop caps because that is often a bugaboo. It just takes way too much time to deal with trying to support drop caps. You might turn that off and then export again to EPUB, open it up to reconvert it to Kindle, see if that works better. And then when you're happy with it, you can then upload the EPUB to Amazon and they'll do the conversion there. Or you could do some more technical fiddling to export out of Kindle Previewer and send them a final file.
The last question I want to get into sort of gets back to this whole discussion. When you're looking for a designer or someone to work with, you want to be sure then that they are fully conversant with all these, like what you were talking about.
Oh, you do. I would say, you had mentioned find a print designer who knows ebooks. I think it's really hard to find. I think if you find a good print designer because you're doing your own print run or you're sending print-ready PDF to CreateSpace or Lightning Source, use them because print design is a different set of skills than ebook design and development. Not every print designer knows that or is interested in that, unfortunately. I wish they all were. But sometimes if your print designer doesn't know ebook stuff, then look for an ebook developer who will take that print designer's InDesign file. Make sure that you get the rights to the working InDesign file. I know some designers want to hang on to that and they don't want you to have the InDesign file. But I would usually give any author who wants the InDesign file, sure, take it. And I've been on that end where somebody will give me print designer's book. I'm working with a client right now whose book was one of the top sellers really on Amazon, the print version. She wanted a Kindle version. We took that and she got some good reviews on Amazon for it. But we took the InDesign file that the print designer had done and prepped it for optimal EPUB export.
So you might actually have to hire two different professionals to work on it.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, aside from going to, I'll give you another plug here, SenecaDesign.com, how do people go about finding professionals to work with?
That's a great question. I guess maybe some of the freelancer resources that are out there, like Elance. There is on Facebook and on Twitter a group called eProduction, and it's E-P-R-D-C-T-N, so eProduction. If you use that hashtag on Twitter, and I do, and you just follow any discussion that includes that hashtag in it, that is where the ebook designer Cognoscenti hang out and have been hanging out for the past 6 years. That's where I hire freelancers from. They're great. One of the people that was very active there, Laura Brady, we hired to speak at our conference called the Print and E-Publishing Conference. And now she's running her own conference. She's based in Toronto and her company mainly does ebook conversions. So she is an expert and very fun to work with, but that is a rich source on Twitter for finding ebook designers. And a lot of them are also print designers. And then a couple years ago, they created an analog on Facebook, the eProduction group, and I'll give you the link to that as well. So there's about, I think, 300 people in that Facebook group that are all dealing with ebook design. And there's a lot of authors there who are asking questions. At the end of all my ebook courses on lynda.com, there's a video called Next Steps, and I talk about the best forums for getting help with your ebook questions, and they're also the best places to find designers.
So final question, Anne-Marie, what do you think is the next big thing, either in the evolution of InDesign, or are there other publishing programs that are coming along as competitors to InDesign that people should keep an eye on?
I think the next big thing is books and browsers. The ebook community is currently wrestling with the issue of what makes an ebook different than a website. Why can't we just put an ebook as a website? Something that could be downloaded or accessed without internet access. That's one of the big differences between an ebook ebook and a website is that you can read an ebook without being on the internet, right? You just carry it around in your Kindle. But because an ebook is essentially a website, when you look inside an ebook, you're able to unzip it and look at the components. They're all HTML files and CSS files. So it's essentially a website in this special little zipped up package. So I think what's going to happen is that the ebook standard is going to align more with the web standard, and we will hopefully it'll mean more ubiquitous ebooks, easier to access and easier to develop. There was a standalone organization called IDPF.org that developed the EPUB standard, and they just merged with W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium. So now the ebook people are part of World Wide Web people, and they're going, I think they just had their first conference in San Francisco a few months ago.
So are you suggesting we're kind of heading toward a globalization where there's one standard and everyone is, if you have something, it's just going to be out there? And
I think there's going to be a way to publish your ebook open source using web technologies. I don't think it's going to stop Kindle and Apple from battling it out to have their own proprietary technology. You know, like if you can get something, if you get an EPUB on Apple's iBook device, you can do a fixed layout EPUB, which is looks like a PDF, but it's an EPUB, and you can sell it there on the iBook store, and you can include animations and videos and sounds, and you can do that right from InDesign, as well as a bunch of other programs, but no other e-reader supports it. You can only see it in iBooks on the Apple mobile devices. Amazon, you can't do that. Amazon has their own software for creating fixed layout books like textbooks. There's no animation or anything involved. Their e-readers aren't large enough or powerful enough to show that kind of thing. So there's still going to be proprietary formats that we're going to have to deal with. But in general, I think we're going to see more convergence toward the web.
I'm not sure that's a world I want to look forward to or not. But thank you very much, Anne-Marie Concepcion, for talking with us today. A tremendous amount of information. You gave a lot of websites and stuff that I'm going to try to include in the program notes. People don't feel you have to listen back to hear this stuff. So good. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
Thanks again to Anne-Marie Concepcion of Seneca Design for sharing all those great observations and helpful tips. You may be screaming now, "Damn it, Jim, I'm a publisher, not a layout slave." Well, that may be true, but at some point, you're going to have to hire professionals to look professional. You have to know the standards of quality and content in order to evaluate the work you're paying others to do for you. You know, IBPA has in the last year published a rather detailed list of standards for indie publishing called the Industry Standards Checklist. It is described as, quote, "at a glance gauge of the professional presentation of any book in order to help level the playing field between indie publishers and large-scale conglomerates." You can find the checklist online. It covers the things your book has to include for it to be taken seriously by the trade. And I don't mean just getting rid of Times Roman forever, but it's what needs to go on your back cover, what kind of metadata to include, how to evaluate design, so on. Lots of stuff. Reading it is like an education in itself, and it is just another way that IBPA is helping you make the best decision for your book. If you're already a member of IBPA, we appreciate your support. Be sure and let us hear from you. If you'd like to learn more about IBPA or are considering joining, check out the IBPA website at ibpa-online.org. So, thanks again for listening to Inside Independent Publishing. Keep your nose in that book. And as my bosses in Japan used to say, let's have publishing fun.